Welcome to World of DAS, a show for data enthusiasts. I'm your host, Warren Hoffman, CEO of Safegraph and GP of Flex Capital. For more conversations, videos, and transcripts, visit safegraph.com/podcasts. Hello, fellow data nerds. My guest today is Austin Allred. Austin is the founder and CEO of Bloom Institute of Technology, a coding bootcamp that helps thousands of students get a job in tech. Austin, welcome to World of DAS.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
I'm really excited. Now, Bloom's kind of pioneered the idea of ISAs or income share agreements as a payment method for your coding bootcamps. Outside of a few coding bootcamps and maybe like schools like Purdue, there's not a lot of institutions that have really embraced ISAs. Why is that?
There are a couple of reasons. The biggest is that schools make less money from ISAs than they do from government-backed loans or charging upfront tuition or other types of loans. I think that's probably the biggest and most obvious is when schools take on more of the risk, they make less money on average. And then another one is the university system and different portions of government view it as a threat and are trying to kill it. And in some instances have successfully done so. So yeah, there are different laws, but everybody has been forced to shift to loan-based products with ISA-like economics tied on instead of ISAs themselves, or different types of instruments that are very, very similar to ISAs in terms of how payments actually flow, but technically different to comply with regulations in different states and that kind of thing. But yeah, I think the bigger one is probably just increased risk doesn't work for a lot of schools. Having people pay nothing if they don't get a job sucks. So don't want to do it.
How does it technically work? So like if there's a student who has an ISA, like what do they sign? Because I imagine like collections is can be annoying and could be somewhat of a problem over time. Does it look like kind of a loan, but it's tied to income or something, or how does it work?
The simplest way to think about an ISA is that it's a contract. So similar to any other contract, I mean, there can be very different terms based on who the provider is, who the servicer is, and for all intents and purposes, most regulators just consider it a loan. So they try to kind of shoehorn it into loan type economics. So as a student, I can speak for Bloom Tech's ISAs. Ours basically says, okay, you agree that if you use our education and get a job that pays over X, then you'll pay us Y percent of your pre-tax income for Z years up to a cap of, I'm running out of variables, up to a cap of N. If you don't, then after some amount of time, the ISA expires and you don't owe anything. And that's baked into the ISA.
If someone doesn't pay you back, and I'm sure in your case, that rarely happens. Let's say that's the worry of like someone who wants to give an ISA that the person doesn't pay them back later. Do you have to somehow prove? Because they could say, well, actually, my income is only X when it's really 2X or something. Do you have to go like prove that somehow? Or
yeah, that's a whole thing. I'm in a whole work stream. The base layer is you're required, according to the contract, to update us as to what your income is. And then at the end of the year, there's a reconciliation where we get your taxes. We don't have a right to get their taxes, but they are required to send us their taxes, or it's a default of the ISA. So it's similar to like if you have a cell phone plan, if you don't make a payment plan, you default on that payment plan. It's not like a car payment. We don't repo your car. There's nothing we can do, but we would declare you in default and you owe. Generally, it's some amount of money that if you default, you're supposed to have paid us. And that's kind of what happens. Obviously, the vast majority of people, it's kind of a pain, but they'll, okay, once my taxes are filed, here are my taxes. And COVID made that exceptionally complicated because everything was super delayed. But generally speaking, for 95% of people, it's, okay, my income changed to this. Here's my pay stub, or I'm just making payments and all is good.
Okay, that makes sense. One of the interesting things is if you're an educational institution providing an ISA, you have in some ways an incentive to like kick out students that are not taking it seriously, maybe not going to class, because you can be pretty confident they're not going to get a job. They don't really know the material, which to me makes sense. It seems like your incentives are kind of aligned with their long-term success. And if they're not there, you might as well give your attention to somebody else that you think is aligned. But I can imagine how certain universities would find that anathema to do that.
that even goes back to admissions. We are more incentivized than any other school to figure out if you're going to be successful. For most schools, if they don't know if you're really going to be successful, who cares? That's on you.
Right, right. As long as they pay, they're fine. Yeah, yeah.
In the current university system, even if I thought that you might default on your student loans, which is relatively difficult to do relative to not graduating or not getting a job, because you could find another way to pay stuff off, and a relatively small number of people are going to default. In the current university system, you don't even care about that. You not only don't care if somebody doesn't graduate or doesn't get a job, you don't care if they even make a single payment on their loan ever. So that's, you know, how you end up with those programs. Like the one that was popular, Wall Street Journal did a report on at USC that was a social work master's degree that cost $120,000 a year. And the median income afterwards was like $30,000 a year. Can't even make the interest payments, let alone start paying down the principal. That ruins you financially for the rest of your life, kind of thing. For us, that's not really possible. First of all, you wouldn't pay us anything because you wouldn't get a qualifying job afterwards. So we would look at that when we're enrolling you and say, hey, do we want to take on this risk? Does this make sense for us? And if we had a program like that, we would just shut it down because the numbers don't work. So the incentive alignment flows all throughout everything that we do.
And so in some ways, just like a company would be really trying to interview somebody and really trying to assess like whether they would be a good fit. And sometimes they get it wrong. They're not going to hire someone they don't think is going to do the work. You're really trying to do something similar where you're trying to really figure out like, are they really going to learn the material? Are they really going to be job worthy at the end?
Yeah, exactly. I think of it almost like in startups, you're talking to investors. The investor is trying to figure out, do I think this company has a chance to go all the way? Is the founder going to do what they need to do? And it's a similar decision because if not, it's not just you don't make money, you lose money. So the ratio of what percentage are successful and repay is far more important than even if there's a standard loan portfolio, because if you enroll 100 people, you're paying the tuition effectively of 100 people. You're covering those costs. And if only 10% of those are successful, then either the 10 have to cover the cost of the 100, which is extremely difficult to do, or you're going to lose money net-net. So it's a different equation than a standard school is, and it's scary for schools. Schools aren't used to underwriting their students. They're not used to waiting for a delay of revenue to come in. It's a completely different structure, and it requires you to operate completely differently in ways that we think are very healthy.
What are some of the things that you learned about people that are maybe non-obvious things that are either like red flags that you should underwrite or green flags that you should underwrite?
Yeah. So when it comes to underwriting, the first thing we figured out is when we started, there are traditional measures and metrics for underwriting, and those didn't predict freaking anything.
Like a FICO score or something. Huh?
Yeah. FICO score. What is their job history like? What do their grades look like? The SAT and comparable cognitive assessments were actually the most predictive thing that we found, outside of the most predictive thing we found, which is just, hey, if we put you in a course in a trial and we start to have you learn how to code, are you able to do that? And do you show up and do you do that? That was by far the most predictive, which in retrospect is somewhat obvious.
In some ways, accepting them is not the biggest problem if you, as long as like every week or every few weeks, you make a decision whether you want to keep working with that person or not. You could have a high acceptance rate, and then like 2 weeks later, if they're not showing up at all the classes, you could say, hey, sorry, we require everyone to show up all the classes. You didn't show up, so we're parting ways.
Yeah, even more so than showing up. This is literally how we operate today. In order to pass, there is what we call sprint zero, and that's all this orientation, free stuff, get your feet wet, writing code. And then there's sprint one. The amount of analysis we've done on all of this stuff is outrageous. Sprint one is moderately difficult. You have to write a bunch of code. You have to learn a bunch of new things. You have to show up just to pass that sprint. So we've actually built our financial instruments such that if you don't pass that first sprint, we don't even really consider you enrolled. So there's kind of a trial.
So it's almost like a pre-enrollment and then an enrollment.
You're technically enrolled, but you don't owe us anything. In our outcomes report and stuff, we look at, of the people who passed sprint one, what happened? Because all sorts of people are going to sign up for sprint one and fail or decide that it's not for them. And we want to know that as quickly as possible. We want you to know that as quickly as possible. And we can all avoid a lot of headache if it's not the right fit for you.
Now, it used to be, let's go back like 50, 100 years, if you want to learn an important skill for a job, you would kind of apprentice for somebody else. And you might be doing some very unglamorous things there, like sweep the floors or do other stuff while you're there. And then over time, you would acquire those skills. And then either you would kind of be made a partner with them, or you would go somewhere else. And that could be like if you're cutting hair, or if you want to be a lawyer, or whatever it is, if you want to learn a trade like plumbing or something like that, that used to be the case. Then at some point, there were schools for all those things. That's where you learned it. If you want to cut hair, you didn't go apprentice with someone. You actually went to like a hair cutting school. Massage therapists go to massage therapy school. Obviously, lawyers go to law school. Why did that shift happen? It seems like the apprentice model in some ways like would be the way better model.
Apprentice model is definitely superior to almost anything that exists now. There are two reasons that that failed and fell down. And in some industries, it does still exist. It's just relatively rare. But the biggest reason is because the right way to think about an apprenticeship model is when there's someone who's brand new, doesn't know anything, the benefit that they provide to the company is pretty minimal, and the cost of that person is very high. But it makes sense to do that in a world where, hey, we're training up, you know, our future employees and they're going to stay with us for 30 years. What happens in software, and we've seen this a bunch of times, is someone will apprentice at a company for a year, and then they get a job offer for twice as much somewhere else, and they jump. And so the company's like, oh, I guess we incurred all the costs and we didn't receive any of the benefit. You can create models that are like, hey, you have to work with us for 5 years, or you have to pay back the amount that we spent training you. But then, you know, people are like, oh, that's modern day indentured servitude. And so it became a hot political thing.
Is it just the cost of minimum wage is so high?
It's the cost of taking the expert away from doing the thing that they do and having them teach you. You have to build a micro school in order to do that. And for a company, it's just, why would I do that? If I can go pick somebody up who is already at that stage, I'm just going to do that. And they can go to school wherever else. So there's kind of this bifurcation of the training and the work.
In most cases, these schools are funded by the state, yours being an exception. But in most cases, the government is funding these schools. So it's like where we used to have the industry teach people, whether it's lawyers or something, like you used to actually work in a law firm, you'd be sweeping the floors. Me only get paid like room and board back then. And you do a whole bunch of things. And then you would slowly kind of work your way up. And then at some point, you would become like either a partner in that firm, or you'd go hang your own shingle, you'd pass the bar exam, et cetera. Same thing with like a haircut, same thing with whatever it might be. Today, you cost $50,000 a year to go to like massage therapy school.
Yeah, it's crazy. So what really happened is the incentive to train somebody for a company went away. If you're going to shift jobs every 3 years, then the incentive to upskill people within your company is relatively small. And employees recognize that wages at a same company wasn't going to grow as quickly as if you job hopped all the time. So the default right now is engineers are not staying at places more than 2 or 3 years in most instances. And that's true, not just in software. My grandpa would have looked at how often I switched jobs early in my career and could not believe it. Staying at a place for a couple of years, that's a good run. But the industry says, okay, we're not training anybody, or we'll build schools and you can pay the school or whatever. There are governments that have done a really good job of incorporating that. So Canada is actually a really good example. The Canadian government's partnership with Waterloo, where Canada says, you know what, we are going to cover the cost of these apprenticeships when all these people go into the company. So as a company, you actually make money to have undergrad Waterloo students interning at your company. That's a no-brainer. And then the government looks and says, hey, actually, if we get all these software engineers trained up, it's going to pay for itself in taxes 10 times over the course of their career. We've done studies. We could easily pay for all of Bloom Tech with a tiny fraction of the increase in taxes that our grads pay. When you're moving somebody from making $30,000 a year for where they don't really pay any federal income tax to six figures a year, now their annual income tax just went up $30,000 a year.
Yeah, even more if they live in California.
And they're going to pay that for the next 30 years. So that's millions of dollars of tax increase for each person we take from minimum wage to software engineer. And we could do that for a few thousand dollars. So it would make sense for the government to lean in there, but it's just, they haven't done that as much in the US. It's really falls back on the student for the student to cover it all. Different in different countries.
You have all these things happening at once, but you also have just the raw cost of education being going up 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation for the last 40 years and just becoming a much, much larger type of thing. Now, people might not always see that cost because they're getting a loan, relatively low interest loan to pay it. You would think with technology and everything, the cost of training people and the cost of helping them along actually should go down over time, not go up. There's a lot of different tools we can use to really help train people at scale. Why is that cost going up so much?
There are a number of causes. So there are causes of what economic features allow that to happen. And that one's pretty easy to point at. Basically, similar to what we were talking about earlier, how a university doesn't have to underwrite the student. They just take the money and it's fully guaranteed by the federal government. So a normal private lender would look at that USC program we talked about and said, we're not lending to those people. They're all going to default. Then there wouldn't be any enrollment and it would shut down in a, you know, traditional private market. What happened is basically the government said, okay, now that training has moved into the university and we really want people to get trained because it's so much better for them, we're not going to pay for it all because that's a handout, but you know, we want people to have some skin in the game. But we will guarantee any loan without any type of looking at repayment because we want equality of opportunity. So basically, students, you can get unlimited amounts of money from the government. And when you're telling that to an 18-year-old, they're shopping and you can say, you can buy whatever you want, pick which university you want to go to. They start going to the university that looks the most posh and not caring what it's going to cost. The amount of money available for 18-year-olds to take out in loans and the cost of tuition rise in direct correlation with each other. And then you start to look at, well, where is that going? Is the quality of instruction getting better? Is the ratio of teacher to student getting way better? And basically, the number of professors and instructors and TAs has stayed basically flat. And the number of administrators has gone up almost 20x over the past 30 years. So it's all going to administration. And then on top of that, what happens is now you have hundreds of thousands of people within university administration who are dependent upon that system continuing to operate. And they're going to make darn sure that it's going to continue to operate exactly the same way it does. It's a difficult cycle. And then politically, if you want to say, hey, let's pull back on that. I talked to, I'm not going to name the particular individual, but someone who is extremely high up in the Department of Education. And they said, look, I know right now that a lot of the loans that we're giving as the federal government are going to people who will never be able to pay them back. I know that. The school knows that. Only the student doesn't know that. And so I said, well, why don't you just cut that off then? Stop doing that. He's like, I would never touch that political third rail. To do that, you have to say, hey, there are people that I don't want to give access to particular programs. And that's just not worth the political risk for him.
If you go to a massage therapy school, you actually do get a pretty good job. Or if you go to a haircut school, or if you go to a plumbing school or electrician school, you probably do get a pretty good well-paying job afterwards. The schools are probably not too expensive and you can like pay them off. But if you're going to like a social work school and paying 100 grand for that social work school, that's like a very different class. It's like intellectually interesting to go do that. And maybe it's fun to go there. If you're taking yourself 2 years out of the job market to go there, it doesn't seem like a good trade.
I talked to a university president of a very prestigious public university. And the reason we were talking is because he said, look, we have 10,000 students a year enrolling in these specific programs. And I know that the 4 years after they graduate, they're going to make less than they would have if they would have just gone and got whatever job they could out of high school and started working up in whatever that is. And that's college grads. And I think that school was 15 grand a year. So they're going to end up with 60 grand in debt with a worse job than they would have had if they did nothing.
60 grand. They still have to pay for their housing.
That's just
other
tuition.
Food and, yeah, other types of things during that time, you know, unless they have a job while they're going.
Yeah. And this is the university president who was a very successful business owner, operator. He came to me because he said, I can't shut that program down or it will cause like a revolt among, you know, I have tenured faculty. There's a whole thing and I can't keep the tenured faculty on unless there's tuition money coming in. So I'm boxed into a corner. So he was talking like, could we find a way to work together to sneak in enough practical skill as a requirement for these types of degrees so they could actually get hired?
It's like the surreptitious way of like, well, let's actually get them skill through another way, another alternative.
Yeah, the gymnastics that he's trying to jump around for something that he knows should be shut down. But even as a university president, he was very wealthy. He theoretically had all the power. He still felt like he didn't have the power to actually do that. And that was somebody that I respect, and he is trying to do his best within those circumstances. The default is you don't really care, or there are entire universities where that's true for 95% of the school. What are you going to do? Shut it down?
But even like top tier universities in money programs, let's say engineering, computer science, et cetera, the quality of the education is not always very good. I mean, I'm thinking myself, I was an engineer, I went to UC Berkeley. My worst classes where I learned the least were the ones taught by Nobel laureates. They just didn't know how to teach. They had a lot of other important skills about them, but teaching an 18-year-old was not one of them.
That's a different incentive problem that universities have, which their appeal to some students is, hey, we have this very distinguished faculty. But the appeal to get those distinguished faculty to be faculty is not, hey, do you want to teach a bunch of 18-year-olds? It's, do you want to get a big salary and do interesting research?
And big lab and postdocs and stuff.
Yeah, right? And well, you'll have to teach a class a couple times a week. You have to do your time there. But there are positive and negatives of research being bundled into a university as well. I'm grateful that we don't have to worry about. For us, if you're there to teach, it's because you love teaching and that's all you want to do in this world. There's a big bundle of issues coalescing all at once.
Now, speaking of college presidents, in the last maybe 6 months, we've seen the heads of Stanford, Penn, and Harvard all fired for various reasons. Is this kind of coincidence or is this kind of a trend? Like, what do you make of all this?
It's a little bit of a reckoning. They're, you know, I don't want to get too terribly political, but those specific organizations themselves became very political. And the way to progress was not necessarily success in academia so much as it was championing political causes. The Overton window of what was acceptable there has dramatically shifted over the last couple of years. I think about that a lot. Just what's acceptable politically to champion and not, and how hard you need to champion it, and how hard you need to pretend like you champion something has shifted. So I think they just got caught up in that. Without going into any of the specific individuals, because then there's more complication there, I think the requirements for being a university president are very different today than they were 40 years ago. And I think what is really happening with this scandal is people are second guessing that. And the presidents of those universities, I think, are just cannon fodder, honestly. They were given roles that in other circumstances wouldn't have been given. And then when people changed their minds about whether that was a good idea, they were fired and they're just caught in the middle of all of that.
What I've seen personally is, let's say, what someone does when they're 17 years old, if they're applying to a four-year university, I haven't seen that these really great universities have made people significantly better. If you have a SAT score of X, let's say you can go to a top tier university or the next tier or the third tier down, whatever. I haven't found that it makes much of a difference when that person is 22. Does Harvard or Stanford or MIT actually teach you more? Obviously, they get people with higher SATs. But if that same student went to a quote unquote less prestigious university, would they actually learn anything less?
Not really. I mean, I think among the more interesting experiments in that regard was the Thiel Fellowship. The design of the Thiel Fellowship was, and there are different strata of universities. To be accepted, at least historically, into the Ivy League, you had to be perfect on the SAT. You had to be perfect in every way, be accomplished in every imaginable way. And Peter Thiel's thesis was that those universities don't add that much value. They are just the gathering place for all of those people who are extremely successful thus far. And so he said, I bet I can take those same people, teach them not really anything, set them out into the world and see how successful they'll become. I mean, from that, we have Figma, we have Ethereum. It's been enormously successful. So I do think, and I don't think this is true at every university. I think the delta between the education you would get at an Ivy League school and a top 50 university is very, very small, if anything. And as this Claudine Gay and Harvard scandal unfolded, I think you saw shades of that because Harvard opened up an extension school where anybody can enroll, you pay outrageous amounts of money, and you get the exact same education that you would get as a Harvard undergrad, and they give you a Harvard degree. But the people who went to Harvard as a Harvard undergrad, not the extension school, hate that because they want to have a Harvard degree that signifies not what they've learned, but how elite they are. And so when Chris Rufo, who caused the whole Claudine Gay Harvard president thing to unfold, when people realized that he went to the Harvard Extension School, they started saying, oh, well, yeah, of course you learned all the same stuff at Harvard, but you're not the same thing. You don't qualify as Harvard. I think that, you know, is symbolic of the fact that, at least at the Ivy Leagues, I don't think this is true across all universities, but the selection nature is far more important than that education itself.
Now, we've been talking a lot of these quote-unquote nonprofit colleges and universities. They're graduating roughly, I think, like 65% of students over 6 years. But the for-profit universities even have a worse graduation record. People are much more in debt. They're having even more trouble. Why is the incentive so disaligned? Just because of what you're saying before, it's just so easy to get that easy federal aid money that you just want to get as many people in as possible.
Yeah, I mean, there are multiple institutions with graduation rates sub 20% pulling in $500 million a year in financial aid. That's a grift. That's a grift.
I could see why senators and Department of Education, they're like, okay, well, I've made this deal with these long-standing state institutions in my state and quote-unquote nonprofits, universities, et cetera. Why does that persist for these for-profit? Many of them are like clearly failing their students. If they're working well, like great. If they're working well, like I'm all for it. But there's many of them like where there's clear data that they're a grift. Why does that persist?
Because while there are for-profits that are clearly a grift, they're not alone in that. As a regulator, you can't just like be like, I don't like that school, shut it down without a cause. You have to create rules and guidelines. And if you were to create a rule or a guideline that would say, you know, let's take the University of Phoenix as an example. I think they have programs that are actually really solid, and they have a bunch of programs that are just a joke, and their enrollment criteria is non-existent. There are grifty aspects of that. But even still, the University of Phoenix still outperforms a whole lot of public schools that are near and dear to a whole lot of people's hearts, including a lot of the HBCUs, the historically Black colleges, where if there's a place that politicians want to make sure people are getting an education, it's those underprivileged populations. There is not, at least I don't know, a rule that would shut down the worst performing for-profit schools that doesn't also shut down 80% of the HBCUs. What do you do if you're a regulator there? I don't know the answer, but that's the reason.
If you're a regulator, you could find a way, like you could give a federal grant to certain types of nonprofits you feel are good. And then you could just say, hey, we're not going to cover loans. If your default rate is over X or something, historically, like we're just not going to give you new loans. Like, there's lots of ways you can do that. Regulators have historically been very good about picking and choosing things like that.
Yeah. So the one that they released most recently was called the 90-10 rule. And that said that only if you're a for-profit school specifically, and there's some nonprofit designations that also matter, but only 90% of your revenue can come from federal aid, basically from grants and loans and all of that stuff. And that rule has been moderately successful.
90% seems super high.
90% is very high. But that is the main bottleneck at most of the biggest schools that are trying to grow, is that 10%. So all of their focus is on growing the 10% to be higher. The rest of it comes free. They can enroll as much as they care to with federal loans. and that 10% becomes the blocker. What I've seen in our world is code bootcamps, generally speaking, don't qualify for any Title IV funding. We have to go figure it out on our own in the private market. Basically, every dollar of revenue that a code bootcamp brings in looks like $10 of revenue to a lot of universities because they could earn, I guess, $9 of revenue.
Why don't code bootcamps qualify for loans, whereas like other types of things in education do? You can get a loan to go to haircutting school. You want to go to massage therapy school, you can get a loan. Like, why not coding?
A lot of those schools actually don't qualify for Title IV, which is the federally backed loans. You can get private loans, but the Title IV, which is the law that kind of is the Department of Education establishing a loan system with subsidized, guaranteed loans, that type of thing. There are a couple of carve-outs, but it's basically you have to be a four-year degree-granting institution that's fully accredited. And a number of boot camps have gone that way and say, okay, let's get the accreditation. But then they find that all the things that are unique about what we do, most of them would have to go away in order to get that accreditation. You can't be job specific. You can't be very practical. You can't be very hands-on. You have to all of a sudden abide by the rules of those governing bodies. And they say, hey, we want you to have 2 years of liberal arts education. So, okay, even if I don't believe in that or think that that's what all of our students want, now I have to throw you into 2 years of liberal arts stuff. Nothing against the liberal arts. I just don't think that every school in every instance needs to teach that. There are different paths and different goals and different objectives. That's a short version, as Title IV has very intentionally limited who is eligible for federal funding to the institutions that will abide by those rules.
I understand at Bloom Tech, you were generating cash even before you did Y Combinator. And then since then, you've raised over $100 million. If you can go back many years, would you have raised that much? Was that the right thing to do?
Yeah, it's a tricky question because on the one hand, it was too much. On the other hand, it was not enough. I think if I would have known what I know now, I would have done things very differently, of course. But at the same time, there's no way to know what I know now without having gone through all of that. I mean, I invest in startups and I talk to founders all the time. And without exception, my advice is always be extremely careful about hiring. Smaller teams are so much better. If I were to restart Bloom Tech again, knowing what I know now in 2017, I would have raised less money. I would have kept teams smaller. But it's tough to say because at the time, we thought that it was so obvious that everything was going to work so well that it was just going to be a land grab and you had to be the biggest and the fastest and the best. What ended up happening is actually it's such a difficult business to make work that huge amounts of money were raised and pretty much everybody died other than us. So if I would have been able to predict that, then yeah, I would have raised less. We didn't know that that was true at the time. We thought it was whoever gets the biggest, fastest wins. And luckily, we were able to raise enough money to be really big, really fast. But in kind of early 2019, we started saying, okay, actually, there's a different approach we have to take here in order to make this work in the long run. We have to productize more. We have to think more carefully about costs. We have to plan on less revenue per student than other schools are planning on. Since early 2020, I mean, we were burning huge amounts of money at the time. And the thought was, we'll just keep burning and raising more. And that was kosher. But we decided to hard pivot and go directly for cash flow positivity back then. And it was harder than we thought it was going to be. But I think we would have been dead if we hadn't done that. And most of the other schools are dead or are very close to dead.
You've talked a lot about hiring executives and how hard it is, especially for a young founder who might not be like a subject matter for what they're looking for. What have you learned from that?
I think about this a lot. I don't know that I have like a generalizable. Now I feel like I know what a great executive looks like. It's still really hard, even in the interview process, to determine whether an executive will be a great fit. One of the things about executives is, generally speaking, they're great communicators. They know about the space more than you. They know how to say what you want to hear. So probably 50% of the potential executives you interview are going to crush the interview relative to what you're used to. So it's just really, really hard to hire for. I haven't found a silver bullet that lets you make sure that you're always hiring a great executive. And then firing an executive is extremely painful, especially if they've hired a bunch of people underneath them or brought people from where they used to work. When you're hiring an executive, you're hiring a bunch of people. A couple of things that I have found that I've at least identified a few red flags that have been true throughout my career. I generally ask, we really need to move this metric quickly. What are the first things that you do? And if their answer is, I'm going to hire 4 people who are then going to hire 5 people each, and then we can get to work, that's a big red flag. I want an executive who is what we call a player coach, who can jump in. You're hiring, say, a VP of engineering. I want them to get their hands dirty writing code before they touch the management piece. So I've become very averse to people who just want to manage and don't want to do the thing. You know, another example is like in a marketing role, a lot of people are like, yeah, look, I know how to do marketing. I know how to do performance-based ads, but I don't. So easy to hire out. I found that a lot of times they have no idea how to do that. They have no actual expertise there.
Also, those things change a lot. So maybe they really did know how to do it 15 years ago, but it's not the same today.
Yeah. And there are people who are extremely successful on resumes in Silicon Valley who jump from role to role. And some of those resumes look phenomenal. And you're like, oh my gosh, you helped X grow to become that wildly successful. And then sometimes you can figure it out in doing references. And you talk to someone who's like, no, they're an idiot. They were just, Facebook wasn't firing people back then. If you were competent, you were along for the ride because they were hiring as many people as they possibly could. And that guy was a bozo. He just was there. And then he did the same thing in those other 2 companies. You're like, oh my gosh, that's, you know, that's crazy. But there are a lot of those out there. It's tricky.
At any level, it's hard to assess certain types of roles. For engineering, it's relatively easy to assess if someone's going to be good. But for something like marketing, as you mentioned, it's incredibly difficult to assess. And, you know, in engineering, my guess is the average engineer at Facebook is quite good. And so even if you just went off the resume, it wouldn't be like the worst thing in the world. And then obviously you have a lot of like very normal questions you can ask people in an interview that would really suss out if they're a good engineer. Whereas like in marketing, my guess is the average person at Facebook is not very good and not clear who would have good marketing people, and then it'd be like really hard to even know how to interview them in the first place.
And that's one of the other things that I learned is I used to be like, oh my gosh, that person was, they were there in the early days at Uber as an example, or Google. They must be so great and they must have learned so much. But if you were early, to borrow your example, if you're in marketing at Google, you could sit on your hands all day and Google was going to absolutely crush it.
Yeah, totally. Just take orders.
Yeah. One of our investors shared that whenever anybody asks him about what product market fit is, one time he went into the old Oracle office. This is like in the early 90s. He's like, all right, you guys are growing like crazy. I need to figure out how you guys do sales and marketing. And he's like, okay, well, let me take you to the sales and marketing floor. Walked up to a guy who was just sitting there and he's like, well, what do you do all day? He's like, I don't know. And the phone rang. He picked it up. He took an order for $500,000. He put the phone down. That's sales and marketing at Oracle. I'm like, okay. Would that person be able to come help your startup grow? Not necessarily. It's just hard.
When we think about execs, at a certain level, you're very good at strategy. And you really want to do strategy. You don't want to do, as you mentioned, the rote stuff, the stuff that you did early on in your career, which kind of makes sense. You can do strategy better than anyone else, but you might not be able to do those PPC campaigns better than anybody else. Is there a sense for certain companies they should just rent execs rather than own them? For a lot of these execs, you could rent them for a day a month. The execs could do like 100% strategy. They would be happier because they're only doing strategy all day long. You could get the benefit of the core thing. And then you have all these other more doer people who get the benefit of these experienced execs without having to have that person all day.
I fundamentally don't believe that that's true, actually. My experience has been craftsman is too strong of a word. There's a difference between, we'll take a marketing executive example again. I don't have time to run ad campaigns or to write copy myself, and I can't. And I think if you're not in the weeds enough to understand all of the individual tiny pieces of what's going on, you're actually not going to be good at strategy.
And for something like marketing, which is changing so often, then that means if someone hasn't been doing it for a few years, they're just not going to be good at it.
My experience has been the people who are best at doing the little stuff are also the best at strategy, and they're not actually unique skill sets.
Interesting. That actually makes some sense with me.
If you're talking about basketball, for example, like who would be the best analyst of a basketball game? Michael Jordan would be a better analyst than any of them. They may be a contrived example, but...
Yeah, interesting. Now, you're super active on Twitter. You managed to be very open about your opinions and your role as CEO. Is that like a feature or a bug? Is that something like more CEOs should do? Or how do you think about that?
It started out, I thought it was a bug. I had a bad habit of being on Twitter. And when we got into Y Combinator, I was like, okay, I'm actually going to shut this off. I'm not going to touch Twitter once during the entirety of Y Combinator. That was my goal. And then about halfway through Y Combinator, we were trying to test something with hiring partners and CTOs. I needed a bunch of people. And I tweeted that we were in Y Combinator and that I needed some feedback from some CTOs. And I got 200 responses within 30 seconds. And I was like, okay, I can't pretend like this isn't valuable. So then over time, it served different functions within the company. There's a time when everything I tweeted and everything I said, even internally, would leak and become an article. That sucked. But it's a trade-off. I think now I have very intentionally tried to push. When I'm saying something controversial on Twitter right now, it's on purpose. Because I want to push the boundaries of what I have said on Twitter. Because I've found that when you do that, people expect personalities to say controversial things or to not say controversial things. And as long as you're within that Overton window of the acceptability of your specific Twitter account, people are less offended than if you're trying to be super professional and you let something slip in, then people are watching you like crazy. So I try to push it.
It's almost like a vaccine. Like if you let it a little bit, it makes you stronger.
Yeah,
and stuff
exactly.
Like
I actually
that.
Use the word, I want to inoculate my Twitter account. And maybe that's a bad strategy. We'll learn in the long run, but it seems to be working so far. We'll see.
Speaking of some interesting tweets, you have this tweet about simulation theory and Mormonism. Can you explain that connection a little bit? I thought that was really interesting.
So that was a little bit tongue in cheek, but I love reading all of the, whether it's religious or science fiction, or whether it's Fight Club or The Matrix, all the different, what is real, what is not, what is, for me, it's just like, if you think about life for even just a second, you're like, this is kind of crazy, isn't it? We're all just sitting on this floating rock, flying through the universe. That's kind of weird.
Yeah.
I can't remember how it came up, but someone was joking about, I was reading a book that, I can't remember the author, but it was basically like, all that we have, even our understanding of matter, is all perceptive based on space-time. And maybe it's all fake. Maybe we're all just living in this giant VR and there is no reality. We see shades of what reality is, but we don't really know. And so I was tweeting somewhat jokingly about that, that space-time was fake and reality is fake and whatever else. And then so someone responded, oh, it sounds like it's the first time you've heard of simulation theory. And I was like, oh. I grew up a Mormon. I'm still an active member of the church. I'm very fallibilist. I don't know what the right answer is, and I don't pretend to know what the right answer is. So anyway, I joke that Mormons also believe in simulation theory because the core tenet of Mormonism is that God, or at least the person that we think of as God, used to be a person like we are now, and our goal is to become like him, and life is basically... I'll use the word simulation. Obviously, that's not the word that Joseph Smith or Mormonism would use. But basically, it's a big test to see how we would do and if we would be able to become like God was. And if you do become like God was, then you kind of perpetuate the cycle and you go create your own universes and children and whatever else. It's a little bit apocryphal and you have to read some old texts that sometimes are taken out of context to get there a little bit. But I was like, yeah, it's basically simulation theory. It's just that instead of alien beings putting us in a computer program, it's God saying, all right, we're going to run a simulation. We're going to call it Earth Life and see how you do. And if you do really well, then after you die, it's good. And if not, after you die, it's bad. There are a lot of religious analogs to simulation theory. It's just who is the creator, who is in charge of the simulation. There are parts of that that aren't true and there are differences that break down, but I was joking a little bit.
It's interesting because for my friends who are like hardcore AI and machine learning engineers, I'd say 5 to 10 years ago, all of them were pretty much hardcore atheists. And then in the last few years, an increasing number of them believe they're in a simulation. So they're essentially become creationists. They've gone from atheists to creationists over
those 10 years.
That's
the interesting thing about simulation theory is if you believe in simulation theory, I mean, you can still be atheist, I suppose, but something created the simulation.
Correct.
Theoretically,
you believe
right?
in some sort of God.
Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting. Maybe we're all just filling our Nietzschean God-shaped hole. I don't know, but it's interesting.
You're also running a rolling fund, and I'm a big fan of these like dual threat CEOs, investors who are also currently operating and running companies. What kind of investor experience or wisdom do you get from like running BloomTech?
My fundamental belief with regard to rolling funds is that as a founder CEO, you're just in a better spot. I don't ever like reach out to people that I'm not interested in meeting. I don't even think of what I do most of the time as investing. I'm just a founder. And as a founder, you stumble upon really interesting people and interesting companies. And I think you have better context to make those judgments. Originally, my rolling fund grew out of my own salary, which wasn't big. So it was like $1,000 here, $5,000 there. And I know as a founder that that's barely even worth the time to cash the check and to go through all the legal hassle of accepting that money. So I was actually talking to Sahil, the founder of Gumroad, about that. And he tweeted out like, hey, I'm going to raise a rolling fund for Austin. Sign up here if you want to participate in Austin's rolling fund. And so really, for me, nothing has changed. In fact, I even hired a guy to do all of the back office stuff. So for me, I just keep living my life as a normal founder. I run into really interesting people and really interesting companies. And instead of me being like, wow, I'm a huge fan, I say, wow, I'm a huge fan. Can I throw in $20,000? And if they say yes, then I send an email to the guy that manages all the back office for me and say, hey, put $20,000 in this company and I'm done.
I get why being a founder CEO would make you a much better investor. How does being an investor make you a better CEO?
I mean, my biggest takeaway from investing has been that all the other stuff, there's market, there's product, there's founder. Basically, I've learned that founder is 10 times as important as anything else. And there are different funds that focus on different aspects of that. They're really successful funds that just look for companies that have an edge on go-to-market, as an example. But I think realizing how long and how difficult it is, you really have to have the right stuff to go all the way. I think it helps me do a check on myself. Where are my gaps? What am I missing? And the other thing is, it's really inspiring and uplifting. Personally, I like it to talk with people who have a lot of ambition. And most of the time when I'm investing, it's very early, not always pre-revenue, but companies aren't doing enough revenue that you can just like run it through an Excel model and determine whether or not to invest that way. You're looking for raw potential and betting on people based on raw potential most of the time. And so that's been really rewarding. I really like that.
Two last questions. First is, what is a conspiracy theory that you believe?
Oh, what's a conspiracy theory that I don't believe? I'll start at the, I don't even know what's a conspiracy theory anymore. Let's see. I have a hard time believing that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. I don't know whether he was the person who shot JFK or not. I don't think it was just like a solo person going rogue and acting independently. So it used to be a conspiracy theory. I totally believe that the COVID virus was created in a lab that was partially government funded.
US government funded.
Correct. Correct. I'll stop there.
Okay. Yeah. Those are some of the classic ones.
Yeah.
For sure. All right. Last question we ask all of our guests. What conventional wisdom or advice do you think is generally bad advice?
Most of it. I had such a big Twitter following at the time. I learned a lot from Twitter and I learned what was going to be celebrated on Twitter. And now, at least as far as management of companies goes, I think most any advice that is going to be widely celebrated on Twitter is probably bad advice. So I think really small teams perform really well. I think ruthless firing without any pip is a better way to run a company. I think micromanagement is either a fake term or a good thing. And for a company to be really successful, and I actually think most people like to be micromanaged. But those are a few of them.
Ooh, I like that one. Most people like to be micromanaged. That would be non-obvious. Why do you think that?
I will say top performers want to be micromanaged. They want to understand what your feedback is. They want somebody to bounce ideas off of, and they're comfortable sharing what they're working on and how they're working on it. The notion of micromanagement implies I'm over here trying to do my work, and then the leadership keeps on like bugging me. And I'm sure that's the case sometimes. If the leadership is doing what the leadership ought to be doing, those times when you're checking in and reviewing stuff are among the most important things that happen in a company. I don't know what the etymology of that word is or where it comes from.
You don't have time to micromanage everyone you work with. In some ways, like if you're spending all this time micromanaging someone, that's not good for you personally, right? It might be good for them, but it's not good for you.
I actually disagree with that too. I think it's painful. Like if you look at most of the most successful companies that have ever existed, the CEO is always in everybody's business all the time. And I think you have to be in order to be successful. And the times when we've done the worst as a company are the times when I've been the most hands-off and like, I have questions here. It doesn't feel right, but I'm not going to like bug that person. That's actually one of my weaknesses is I don't want to bother you and I don't want to be overwhelming. But every top performer that I've ever worked with is actually like begging, please, like, I want to know what you think. I want you to be more involved. The more involved you are, the more aggressive you are, the more intense you are, the better my life is. That's, you know, another thing of conventional wisdom is you actually do not want all of your employees to be happy. You want the top performers to be happy and you want the low performers to be super annoyed and pissed off and you have to fire them or let them quit. So the people who operate on a mental model of how's everybody feeling, it's the wrong metric. And that was me.
One more question for you. So your name is Austin, A-U-S-T-E-N.
Correct.
I can imagine that has caused you a lot of interest over the years because it's very different from the city. Do you think your life would be different if it was I-N?
The reason my name is Austin, A-U-S-T-E-N, is actually my mom was a big fan of Jane Austen, and that's how you spell her name. My wife and I talk about this a lot because she has a funnily spelled name too. And it's annoying at times. I don't even notice if people spell my name A-U-S-T-I-N. But I will say it is great for usernames and domain names and much less competition.
I follow you at Austin, A-U-S-T-E-N on Twitter. I imagine it would be much harder to get the I-N.
Yeah, if you're trying to get John, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Okay, this is great. Well, as I mentioned, I follow you on Twitter. I definitely encourage our listeners to engage with you there. Thank you again, Austin Allred, for joining us at World of Desk. It's been a ton of fun.
Awesome. Yeah, it's been great. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, consider rating this podcast and leaving a review. For more World of Desk, and Desk is D-A-A-S, you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. And also check out YouTube for videos. You can find me at Twitter at Auren, that's A-U-R-E-N, Auren, and we'd love to hear from you. World of Desk is brought to you by Safegraph. Safegraph is geospatial data for physical places. Check it out at safegraph.com. And by Flex Capital. Flex Capital invests in data companies like those we talk about at World of Desk. Check it out at flexcapital.com.